John Donne was a learned man, one of the great men of his age. Pretty impressive for an age that included William Shakespeare and Sir Francis Drake. A politician, poet, clergyman, and, as you Episcopalians may know, a saint of the Church of England. But all that would come later. In 1612, Donne was a country lawyer with a growing family who served in Parliament for free and wrote poems for noblemen for favors. He found himself a whale of a patron in Sir Robert Drury. Sir Robert not only paid for John Donne's poems, but gave the Donne family a home in his own house on Drury Lane. On this evening in 1612, he brought Donne along on what was to be a grand tour of France and Germany. Donne was anxious about going. His wife Anne was expecting their eighth child any day now. But when the patron says, "Let's go to Paris," you go to Paris. For now, they stopped for the night in Amiens and sat down to dinner with the rest of their party. The evening waned, the room emptied, and Sir Robert and the others wandered away, leaving Donne alone in the chamber. Sir Robert was only gone a few minutes, but it was the most unsettling interval of John Donne's life. As he sat alone, perhaps smoking his clay pipe, perhaps scratching a verse or two out with a pencil, a woman appeared, as if from the ether. She wore only her shift, with her hair hanging loose around her shoulders. And in her arms, she clutched a small bundle. Donne started to his feet, just in time to see the woman sweep out of the room. He stood, stunned. Should he follow? But before he could rouse himself to move, the woman entered again. This time he watched her closely. Closely enough to discern that the bundle in her arms was the pale body of a dead child. His heart sagged with pity for the poor woman. Then, as if she could hear his sympathy, she raised her eyes from the wretched infant and looked him full in the face. Only then did he recognize the woman he married in secret years ago, the woman he had left in childbirth on the Isle of Wight. Before he could utter a word, she vanished like a mist. It's said that Donne recounted all this to Sir Robert that night. Sir Robert supposed it must have been a dream, but Donne was adamant that he had not slept, and that it could not have been a dream. He wrote to his family straight away and couldn't relax until he at last reached Paris and learned from messengers that his wife was in fact alive, and recovering, however slowly, from a difficult labor and delivery. The baby, on the other hand, was stillborn on the very night of Donne's vision. This week, we're talking about the doppelganger. I'm Dory Peacock, and this is The Ghost Box. The familiar word doppelganger is surprisingly new. Its first recorded use was in the 18th century German novel Seibenkaß. Funnily enough, it was used in the novel the way we use it today, to refer to two people who are not related but look uncannily similar. The word was popularized in English in the 1840s by Catherine Crowe, who used it to describe the ghostly apparition of a living person. But by the time Crowe published her book, The Night Side of Nature, the idea of evil twins and mischievous double spirits was already popular in literary circles. E.T.A. Hoffman, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Romantic poets all wrote works with mysterious doubles. Shelley and Goethe even claimed to have seen their own doubles. But all those poems and novels were metaphorical. They were about the duality of man. And no one really knows what Shelley and Goethe were smoking. I never expected to find a real doppelganger story. But I found two. The first was from my friend Mary.
I think there have been, like I said, two or three times where I've ever felt threatened, one of which was while my mom, who is a Reiki master, was doing Reiki on me. And my mom did the whole protection thing, everything like that. And I'm laying there getting Reiki like I had done several times before. I'm trained in Reiki as well, so it was nothing out of the familiar until I opened my eyes and there was the spitting image of me in like ghost form, but with like glaring red eyes staring down back at me. I cannot tell you how fast I ran out of that room.
That's wild. What do you think it was?
Probably my inner demons, like inner negative energy my mom was getting rid of. I was going through a breakup at the time.
To me, Mary's story seems more along the line of the work of the Romantic poets, a double that represents the hidden and shadowy part of the self. But traditionally, the doppelganger, or spirit double, was an ominous figure, a doer of mischief, or a portent of something to come. It's said that a double of Helen of Troy appeared to Paris, helping to end the Trojan Wars. In Western European mythology, the words fetch in English and vardagr in Norse represent a spirit that performs one's actions in advance. The fetch can be an omen of good fortune if it appears in the morning or bad fortune in the evening. The vardagr is almost always a sign of impending doom, like the apparition seen by John Donne. Our next story takes a different tack, however. This story is from a professor named Carrie, whose doppelganger tried its best to work mischief through her.
So this was something that happened quite a while ago. I was in England. I was teaching a study abroad class with a bunch of BYU students. And it was like 20 girls and two boys. Like it was a very, a lot of girls there. I was teaching the writing class and there was another professor there teaching a literature class, but it was like a wilderness writing class. So we would hike and we would hike a lot. We hiked sometimes 20 miles a day. We summited 7 mountains. It was exhausting. I was not like a hiker or anything. I had sort of ended up doing this trip in a roundabout sort of miraculous way where we had been trying to have a baby and had found out that we were completely infertile, that there was no way to have a baby without in vitro. And I was in grad school at the time and my husband was a reporter making like $20,000 a year or something. And it was not within the realm of possibility at the time, because the time I think in vitro was about $10,000 a cycle, took like 3 cycles. I knew through, I had a weird dream. This all started with a weird dream. So that just made the entire situation even sort of stranger, where these children that looked like me, or these people that looked like me, said that I had to find them. And I said, okay, where do I have to find you? And they said, well, we're in England. And at the time, I didn't know that I was infertile when I'd had this dream. And I found out thereafter. And at first I was like, maybe these are ancestors, because Mormons care a lot about their ancestors. And maybe I'm supposed to go do my genealogy in England. I do have ancestors that lived in England, incidentally. But then later on, when we found out that we were infertile and I'd had this dream, I thought, well, maybe these are my children telling me how to find them. Why not? So I Googled, and the drugs for in vitro were actually invented in England. And one of the first, I think the first in vitro baby was born in London. At the London Women's Clinic, where I ended up doing the in vitro. But it was so much cheaper in England. It was because the drugs were invented there, because of a whole lot of reasons. Healthcare is just in general cheaper in the UK. And so it was gonna be $3,000 instead of $10,000. And I was like, well, that's better. And then shortly after I found out that it was gonna be $3,000, this man who had never spoken to before approached me in the hallway and said, I need somebody to teach a study abroad class. It's in England, it pays $3,000. And so I said, excellent, I'm in on the spot. So I ended up on this hiking trip, this wilderness hiking trip, even though I'm not a hiker, even though I had no desire in my life to ever be a wilderness writer. That's not something. Hiking 20 miles a day is not really like my idea of a great time. But we were doing this. So we would hike 20 miles a day over 7 mountains. We did all sorts of this. So we did it while I was undergoing a round of in vitro. So in vitro is super brutal on the body. It is, they start by shutting off your pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland is not only responsible to create your hormones for pregnancy, it also is responsible for managing your physical and emotional stress. And we were hiking 20 miles a day with BYU students who, I don't know if you are familiar with BYU students, but they are, they're anxious. Kinds of students that like to go on a hiking trip that where you hike 20 miles a day are extra anxious. So there was a lot of stress going on this time as we're hiking, and I don't have the ability to deal with physical and emotional stress. And there was one drug that they started me on in the clinic, and they started talking to me about how, well, this kind of drug has been known to cause homicidal tendencies. And I started laughing in the clinic because I thought that they were kidding with me with their cute London accents, and they just stared at me like, why are you laughing? This is about murder. And I realized they were serious, and I was like, oh, okay. And then I thought in my head, like, well, they must be exaggerating. They must be being dramatic about this. So they weren't sure what was going to happen to me because I was very young. Mormons like to have babies very young, and they had never had a patient as young as me I'd been trying to have a baby for like 4 years, and I was like 23 years old. They'd never had a patient that young before. They thought that was very strange. And so they were really worried about overstimulating my ovaries. They didn't know how much drugs to give me. They'd never been tested on anybody my age. They're like, this could kill you. We're literally messing with your brain. We have no idea what's going to happen. And a lot of strange things did happen to me. Like, I was emotionally just a wreck. Physically, my ovaries each, I think, swelled to about the size of, they said football, which was like a soccer ball. They were very big, just very physically uncomfortable. I had nightmares every night. And I started like seeing things, but not really seeing things. It was more like really, really, really vivid thoughts that felt almost real. I tried to explain them to the clinic, and I'm like, this is weird. And they're like, well, again, we're literally messing with your brain. We have no idea what's gonna happen. And so I would have these terrible nightmares. They'd be like demons, or like I would wake up and I'd be sure that there was like bloody cat fur stuck between my teeth. And then I would see ghosts. Everywhere we went, I would see ghosts. And I was like, well, we're in England, but of course there's gonna be ghosts, maybe. So one day we were hiking to a place called Milton Abbey, and it was a very dark hike. There was deep, thick forests, and England used to be mostly forest. It was farming and sheep raising, I think, in particular, that turned it into a less forested space. It's a very wet, some parts of England, if the temperature was lower, would be a tropical rainforest type because of how much it rains and the trees. And in the medieval time period, it was 98% forest, I think I read once, or at least that's what it used to be a long time ago. But there used to be lions. There used to be like all sorts of wild lynxes and things that were sort of terrifying that lived in the woods. And I was thinking about this as we were walking through this very thick wood, and the ground was mud, and my feet were heavy with it as we were walking with this mud. And I felt emotionally, I felt like everybody was looking at me and that everybody hated me. I'm sure that some of them probably did. I was teaching a class and I was young and I didn't quite know what I was doing yet as a teacher, but also they were probably more worried about themselves, but I was sure that they were looking at me. And as I was walking, I started to have one of those sort of dreamlike, vivid hallucination thoughts. I saw myself and I was a spirit, and I was floating next to myself, and I was looking at myself, and she was looking at me, but she wasn't, and I wasn't sure what was happening. And I'm like, that's awesome. I'm just gonna have like a hallucination of myself now. That just sounds great. Super self-centered and everything. Oh, fine, whatever. And it felt like she was connected to me through this elastic, this spirit was, and she would sort of drift away and dripped back and dripped away and drift back. And at one point, she decided to talk, the spirit that's looking at me. She says, you could be rich. And being rich was not something I had ever really cared about. I mean, I married an NPR reporter. I was in grad school studying English. Like, this is not, like, monetary gain is not something I had ever really considered to be important in my life. But in this moment, in this very dark forest, with my mud heavy shoes and this feeling that lions and lynxes and BYU students were looking at me, it seemed like a really great idea. Like, I had never wanted to be as rich in my entire life as I did in that moment. And two people walked by and they were talking about, like, boyfriends or whatever BYU students talk about. And I wasn't sure if it seemed like a private conversation, one of those conversations that, like, I don't know if they knew that I was hearing them or not, or I wasn't sure if I was supposed to listen or stay rude, and I was awkward, and so I sort of slowed down. And they kept walking. And this spirit that looks like me says, when you're rich, you'll be powerful. And people will want to hear you speak. They'll cry, they'll applaud. And again, this sounded great. I was like, okay, that sounds great. And this elastic feeling of this spirit got stronger and weaker and stronger. And she seemed, this elastic got stretchier, and maybe she was farther and higher and getting closer and moving. And then she comes and she looks at my husband, Steve. We're not married anymore, but I still like him. He was a good guy, and he is a good guy. And she said, he's probably going to be an apostle, a Mormon apostle. And everybody will want to see you and want to hear you. Everybody will fawn. And somebody right then bumps into me as they're walking, and I fall a little further back in line. And the spirit says, when you're rich and when you're powerful, nobody is going to bump into you. They're going to rue the day that they bumped into you. And this is when I started to feel a feeling that was completely unfamiliar to me. Like, it just was something I had not experienced in my entire life. It was this mixture of greed and bloodlust. And this spirit says, it's very easy to do this. There's only one thing that you need to do. I'll show it to you. And I saw sort of this picture of this person that bumped into me. I saw them falling down a cliff, this deep cliff, just into the air. I was looking at them and they were looking at me. And I saw arms pushing them, and they were my arms. And then I sort of turned around and saw myself, and I was standing at the edge of the cliff, and I was smiling as I was watching them fall. And there was something about this image that was very shocking. It's a shocking image, but the rest of it was shocking too. But this particular image made me stop. I stopped walking. And the hikers kept moving forward, and they were like this body of water. And I was this rock, and it was like a sensation of the entire world and all of reality was river pushing forward. And I was stuck there. And I looked at this spirit that looked like me, and I said, who are you? Because you're not me. And she smiled. And then she sort of disappeared. I shook myself because I was like, that was creepy. And maybe they weren't wrong about the homicidal tendencies, and whatever is going on in my head is just really a lot. And I never want to do IVF again. If I survive this, this is terrible. I don't know what to do. So I just kept walking, because what do you do if you don't know what to do? You keep walking. And we got to an abbey, Milton Abbey. And Milton Abbey is an ancient abbey with sort of a curse history, but I didn't know that at the time. It was founded in 900 AD by a king named Athelstan. And we got to the Abbey, and I was hot and I was cold. I was sweaty, but I was shivering. My skin felt like it was on fire, and I was so exhausted. And this grand, gothic, huge, beautiful Abbey, I felt bored looking at it. My shoes were so heavy with mud, I left them at the door, and I was walking around in socks, and they were wool socks. And they were sort of ugly wool socks because it was summertime and we were trying to prepare for the trip. And they said, bring wool socks because it's going to be cold sometimes. And the only socks that I had were these ugly, like, stripes. I was embarrassed. They were terrible. So I was walking around and my feet were wet, and they would leave these wet footprints everywhere we went. And there was just wall after wall of names graved in the wall, people that were buried here and their noble patrons, giving lots of money to have some sort of hollow carving in rock. And I had picked up a pamphlet about the history of the Abbey, and I wasn't paying very good attention to the details as I read. And in my memory, some of them mished together, but the cursed history of the Abbey sort of played out where Athelstan was this king. He wanted to be king. He had visions of king. His brother was dead. He had killed his brother. And what did he do when he killed his brother? He built this abbey. And then the next king that's mentioned as they're talking about it threw all of the priests out. I don't know if he killed some of them, but in my mind he did. And brought in new monks. And then there's this massive fire that destroys the abbey. And then there's this man that comes in, and he is ambitious, and he wants power, and he marries the daughter of a duke, and she dies, and he erects a statue for her. And there's a town nearby, or was a town, that is slowly razed, just destroyed house by house by house by house until there's nothing left, because they had to build the grandeur, the glory. And I started, as I was reading this pamphlet, just seeing that spirit over and over that I've been talking to in this woods, this spirit that says, you could be great, and you could be powerful, and you could be glorious. And there's just one thing that you need to do first. And the whole history of the Abbey was this sort of tale of destruction, and it all just sort of conglomed into like that image of the fire of everything burning to the ground, where you just have to do one thing first. And I think I told Steve about this later, but I didn't tell anybody at the time. I put the pamphlet down and I just walked back out into the foyer. I put my shoes back on and I left.
On a historical note, I looked up King Athelstan. He didn't, in fact, kill his brother. He built Milton Abbey in honor of his brother, who died of sickness while abroad. But Lord Milton did raise the village eventually and move it over to a different location, now called Milton Abbas. It's been called one of the first acts of urban planning in British history, but try telling that to everybody whose cottages were razed. Could the occupants of Milton Abbas, Lord Milton himself, King Athelstan, and all the lords and ladies in between, could they have been led by the doppelganger curse of the hill? I don't know. And now, I'm off to find myself. If I return before I'm back, don't trust me. Thank you for listening. The Ghost Box is written, produced, performed, and all the stuff by me, Dory Peacock, with mixing, editing, and scoring by Parker B. Abeg, who you can find on Twitter at Parker B. Abeg. Special thanks, as always, to our four-legged furry production assistant, George Moosington Adams Esquire, because of course my cat is a lawyer. Yes, he is. And special thanks to Colin Hill for letting me record in his house and kick his cats out of the room. I want to thank our patrons this week, including Martin Estrada Jr., who is our latest Archangel level patron. If you are interested in supporting the Ghost Box, go to patreon.com. Patreon is this great website where you can give small monthly donations to help support independent creators like yours truly. So if you would like to toss a coin in the box, as we say around here, go over to patreon.com/theghostbox or just patreon.com and search The Ghost Box Podcast and sign up for the donation level that suits your financial needs. In return, you will receive cool bonus material like monthly streamings that I do, where I do like a Q&A thing or just something interesting like that. Also, bonus material. That's always fun. Bonus material. And patron gifts, that's a new thing I'm doing, a sticker, special sticker for patrons, and so much more. If you have a story that you'd like to share with us, you can email us at theghostboxpod@gmail.com or slide into our DMs on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at theghostboxpod. You can also call our paranormal hotline. The number for that will be in the show notes. Thank you again for listening. If you like this show, why not rate and review on iTunes, Spotify, or the platform of your choice? It helps people find the show. And if you didn't like it, I don't know what to tell you, man. I'm doing my best here. Thanks again for listening. Stay spooky, everybody. Snarfington Station was a quiet train station before everybody blew their lids. People like to talk about how snarfy it was, and the answer is very, very snarfy indeed. And now for the Gay Men Snarfing Chorus of Los Angeles.